Chatter on Books. It's Cliff Notes for book clubs. Why read the book if you can listen to Chatter on Books? I'm Jamie McIntyre, your announcer. But you don't care about that. Here again is your host, Tori Clark.
Welcome back to Chatter. We have so many things to cover in a little while, about 15, 20 minutes from now. We're going to talk to our featured author, Mark Medley, who is this incredibly talented journalist who has a wonderful book called Live to See the Day, which everybody should read that this at this time of year. It's very inspirational. It is about people, a whole wonderful Noah's Ark of people who, against all odds, against any hope, go after these impossible dreams. It's very Don Quixote. I love it. It's great. We also, very excited, we have our second nomination for The Pitch with our dear friend Nancy Bannon from Arcadia Books in Wisconsin, Spring Green, Wisconsin. And before I die, I'm going to get the name changed to Green Spring, Wisconsin, because that would make more sense. Nancy and Jim, hang in there for just a minute. Okay, so we're talking about Snowmageddon here in the DMV. David, don't shovel snow anymore.
I just did, and there's nothing I can do about it now.
Okay, those heart attacks come in later. So if you know if the arm starts to go, just wave. We'll send somebody.
It's okay. I'll be found in a couple of days. My wife's out of town.
So, Tori, did you have this experience? I don't know if you had this in downtown DC that we had out in the Maryland suburbs, but the snow was this time was like snow I'd never seen before. It was the consistency of beach sand or sugar.
Absolutely.
It didn't stick to anything. Like all of our, when the snow comes, there's beautiful snow covered trees and bushes.
Yeah.
Didn't stick to anything. Didn't stick to the cars. You couldn't make a snowball or a snowman.
Yeah, it was closer to hail than it was snow. Well, in Sperryville, same thing. Absolutely.
And you would shovel it and it would just fall off your shovel because it was like shoveling sand. And so we had 14 inches on the ground, but there was only an inch on our roof because on the roof with the slant,
which is good.
It just slid off the
roof.
That's
what you want.
Down.
What I love about snow in the DMV, and we don't have snowstorms that often anymore, is it is a high state of panic every single time.
Mm-hmm.
And it started days before, and the local news media contribute to this. You know, they break in with live shots of somebody standing, getting ready for it. And it makes me remember Wendy Rieger. God bless her soul. Do you remember Wendy Rieger, Channel 4?
Yeah.
Rest in peace.
I was good friends with Wendy.
She had a place out in Sperryville. Anyways, in her early years, Wendy was not high on the totem pole at Channel 4. And she seemed to always get sent out to those salt facilities 3 days before the snowstorm would hit. And I can say this because I think I can say this. I think she might have stopped somewhere at a watering hole before she got to the salt facility. Because there would be Wendy, 11 o'clock at night, reporting from the non-existent snowstorm that was going to come in 4 days from the salt facility and just have the greatest time talking about the preparations for it. But it was a nice distraction from what usually goes on in Washington, D.C. these days. So I think that was good.
Well, you're the guy that gets stuck in the snowstorm and has somebody walking over to you with a camera. Channel 4, see, you got stuck in the snow. I would have flipped the bird so quickly and made the whole broadcast unbearable with the curse words. I would have been screaming.
Absolutely.
I've been here for a lot of big snows in Washington, and my first big one was in 1979, Washington's birthday.
Yes, I remember that.
And I was a young editor at WTOP Radio, and my news director, Ed Tobias, dispatched a helicopter, I'm not making this up, to come get me in Alexandria and fly me into the district so I could help relieve the beleaguered WTOP radio staff that had been snowed in there for 24 hours.
Holy moly.
And we were WTOP Radio was located in the Stewart Petroleum Building right next door to Channel 9 Broadcast House in 40th and 40th. And because it was owned by a petroleum company, they had a helipad on the roof for the bigwig oil executives. And I posted about this on Facebook over the last week with pictures of the helicopter that flew me in. That was a 23.6 inch snowstorm.
Wow.
And,
okay.
We've had a lot of
dangerous.
Since then. We've had a lot of snowstorms since then.
Helicopters are dangerous at the best of times. You should not be flying them in bad weather.
Just like you shouldn't be shoveling snow, Jamie.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
This is kind of a worrywart these days.
I apologize. I have to go rescue a small dog that has gotten herself trapped somewhere. Please hold.
Okay.
Right back.
Here.
Please, Jamie. Stand by.
Jamie, now that the show is ours.
You're experiencing a brief technical interruption. No adjustment to your set is necessary. Our crack team of technicians is on the case, and we will resume the podcast shortly.
Do you remember when in the old days when you'd have technical difficulties and they'd throw that Chiron up?
Yeah, they'd show a little a cartoon. It would have like a guy with
little guy with his hands up like
with two plugs, like trying to plug them together. It would say, "We are currently experiencing technical difficulties."
Sorry about that. Lulu the dog is Brian's problem now. Okay, Nancy Bannon from Arcadia Books, welcome back. We're here in the DMV complaining about the weather, where it's a balmy 15 degrees, 7 degrees in Spring Green, Wisconsin today.
Maybe. I don't know. It was
-5 this morning.
Yeah. On Friday, I think our real temperature was -20.
Oh,
and with the wind
chill,
it was supposed to feel like -48. I don't know what that range is. Why it wouldn't be -40 or -50. I don't know how they circled in on
the good thing is that, like 3 degrees feels warm after that.
Yeah, I know. I'm walking out.
Yes. What is that on the Kelvin scale? I'm just trying to do the calculation.
The European model versus the American model. No, I spent a lot of time in Minnesota, and last winter was very cold, and it was pretty frequently 17, 20 below. And it's true, Jim. You get to zero, and you're like, whoo-hoo, this is nice.
If the wind doesn't blow, it's fine.
Right.
Yeah, that's very, very true. Okay. We have welcomed Nancy back because she is second up in nominating authors for The Pitch. And just to remind people, The Pitch is about how much we love independent bookstores and how we think there's an incredible amount of talent across the country, not just in the coasts. And so about a dozen independent bookstores are nominating authors from their region with a book out this year, first half of this year. So Nancy, welcome back. Thank you for doing this. Introduce us to your author and his wonderful new book coming out.
So our incredible talent lives like two blocks from the bookstore.
Nice. Good vibes.
So I'm going to introduce Sanctuary by James Cleary.
Okay. Nice cover.
I know. It's a really nice, it's great art.
It's a great cover. And so James Cleary, to me, is my friend Jim DeVita. So Cleary is James's mom's maiden name, which he took on as his pen name. On the advice of his agent.
Yes. Can I interrupt for a quick second? I'm fascinated by pen names. And while I'm yakking here for a second, David first, then Jamie, what would your pen name be if you had one? Jim, you are a multi-talented person. I mean, when you've written a YA, you're an actor, a playwright. Is it because of that that you thought you needed a pen name?
Yeah, basically, I didn't know that I needed it, but my agent and her house suggested it. But basically, I mean, the short answer is the lion's share of my published work has been for young audiences.
Uh-huh.
So this is a new genre for me, too, and new audiences, readers. I mean, if they Google me, that it may mean, he writes for kids. So just kind of wanted a clear slate on this new genre for me and new name. And
nice. I like your mom's maiden name. Okay, wait, hang on, Nancy. David, pen name?
I have no idea.
Okay, Jamie?
I don't know. Al, wait.
You know how you get your porn star name?
No, how do you get
Let's not go there.
We did this on Tony Kornheiser's show once. It's your first pet. Your first name is your first pet, and your last name is the first street you lived on.
Yeah. So that, for me, that would be Tiny Abington.
That's not a good name for
a turtle. A little turtle named Tiny, and I lived on Abington Drive, which is in Alexandria.
It's good. Up. You'd be like a little British porn
All
star.
Right, my pen name would be Alex Haley. How about that? See how that works out for me.
Okay, I'm sorry, Nancy. Back to you.
Oh.
Okay, so Jim's book, and Jim is an actor. Has been a Jim grew up in Long Island.
Uh-huh. I'm a Long Island boy.
And came to acting in a roundabout way. Thought you were gonna be like a fisherman.
Yeah, I worked in the fishing boats off of Long Island.
Oh, that's right. You were a sailor too, sailor fisherman guy.
From like 18 till I was 22-ish or so.
Yeah.
Late starter, went to community college. I'm a big advocate of community colleges, saved my life. dropped out of two community colleges finally. And the third time around, I saw theater, which I'd never seen before, and got interested in theater and started reading. And I'm still sometimes I'm surprised that where I am today. So it's like, how did I get here?
So join the club.
When Jim's on the stage, even if he's not saying a word, you're watching him. It's just, he just has that.
Eats up the scene. Yeah.
And he's probably not happy I just said that, because one of our practices with Jim has been to be like, you can brag about yourself, or not even brag, we can celebrate your wins, because he's had these incredible wins with this book in particular. It's sold everywhere, France, England,
France,
Italy,
Italy, and Germany. So it's a big one for me. It's been 30 years writing. Yeah.
Jim, this is the Jamie McIntyre question, but I'll ask it. Give us the CNN headlines version, the plot of the book. I'm post-apocalyptic, but very current, correct?
Yeah, it's in the near future in the United States. There's been a climate catastrophe. We're basically suffering another dust bowl. The Ogallala Aquifer has been dried up. The coasts are flooding also. As they say, the dry gets drier and the hot and the wet gets wetter, which, of course, runs into so there are crop failures, water shortages, leading to social unrest, basically really bad social unrest in the United States. And the story is about a billionaire who has prepared for this. And has built an underground, multi-billion dollar underground bunker, which is actually based on something I really read about, which is the bunkers in out in the West that have been people have bought decommissioned missile silos.
Yeah. Aren't the tech bros doing this?
Oh, yeah.
It's
that's right.
The tech bros.
About 3 years, we started reading, about Thiel buying land in New Zealand, Zuckerberg in Hawaii. And that's where we read an article. My agent sent me an article in The Guardian about bunkers that were being built. This was about 3 years ago. So this has been happening in the United States, and we have this character, Brandt, who is a billionaire, who has designed this thing and escapes to it during the civil unrest. But of course, he has to take the long people to take care of the place. It's big, it's huge. You know, it's like running, an 18, like a skyscraper under the ground.
Sure. Basically.
So it's great. We have a little microcosm of all different socioeconomic classes inside there. It's kind of a locked room. Thriller also. But not only that, we have people outside trying to get in also. And people outside are dying. And I got the idea I really got was in that I read something that, of course, they all have special ops. And it's in real life too, guarding these places. But one of the special op gentlemen said, it really doesn't worry me about people trying to get in with guns. What worries me is the mom with a child trying to get in. He said that moral dilemma. And that was really the germ for in my mind, the conflict in the book, the people trying to get in. So it looks like Mad Max at first. It's not at all. But once the dust clears, you see these are men and women from a small town like our town here. We're a town of about 1,600 that have children with them, and they're trying to survive and live. So it's much about abundance versus want to,
It all sounds too freakishly possible. Right. It sounds very scary. I read a small excerpt of it and I went, well, yeah, this is probably happening right now. How much, if anything, did the pandemic affect the writing of this or inform your writing of this? Because I get the sense when the pandemic was happening, that's when Chatter moved. Chatter used to happily take place, the tapings, in a bar, which was just great. And then a dining room. And then the pandemic hit. So we switched to Zoom, which has its pluses and minuses. But one of the things we talked about during the pandemic was, when do we start feeling or sensing or realizing that the pandemic itself is starting to shape writing? And God, there's so many wonderful people in the entertainment world who talk about you're just now starting to see the impacts of the pandemic in movies and plays and things like that. But did it affect how you wrote this at all, Jim?
I don't know if it fit, but I certainly remember. I think there's even a line in the book, something about, during the pandemic, we're almost killing each other over toilet paper. Imagine if we had no water. Imagine if we had no food.
Yeah.
Where we would be. So I know that, yes, I'm not even sure yet how it's affected me, but you certainly saw a different side of neighbors during the COVID. Humanity, our country, we saw different sides of people you hadn't seen before.
So I won't ascribe this to David or Jamie or Claude, because they're much nicer people than I am. But if you're from the DMV, you can always make everything about yourself. So, we're here to talk about you and talk with Nancy, but we'll talk. Everybody, almost 25 years ago, 9/11, which is mind blowing. It was 25 years ago, but people kind of forget. We had a bad anthrax scare in Washington, D.C. And anthrax is something that is terrible. It's bad, but it can be treated, antibiotics, those kinds of things. People in the DMV went bananas, and our kids were little at the time, and we had the pediatrician that everybody went to, And the pediatrician's office needed to have security come and man the doors because crazy moms were storming in saying, you have to give my kid the antibiotics now. You have to give them a vaccine now. And that was in Washington, D.C., where you would like to think these people were relatively, but the panic that had set in was pretty extraordinary. So again, what I've seen of the sanctuary so far, I think, no, this is very possible, really possible. So
when I heard about the premise of your book, two things jumped to mind. One was, because I'm an old guy, was the classic Twilight Zone episode.
Yeah.
It was called The Shelter. And I, you know, like one guy in the neighborhood had built a bomb shelter. And then there was a warning of an incoming nuclear attack. And he goes in the shelter and then all the neighbors try to get in. And the end of the Twilight Zone episode was it was a false alarm, but it was to display, you know, like how would humans react if their only chance of survival was to get in somebody else's bunker? So that occurred to me. And then, of course, being a billionaire myself, and I, you know, as Teresa, you make it all.
You have a safe room.
I've actually thought about this a lot. About what if I were a billionaire and I could make this fabulous bunker to save me and my family. And of course, as you point out, you'd have to have staff, you know, the security people and
totally,
and the chef mm-hmm. and the au pair. And then they have family. So how can you get them to come if they can't save their family? And so I'm curious about how you dealt with that conundrum, because it seemed to me when I was trying to have this thought experiment in my head about how once I got my $1 billion and then I made my bunker, how I was going to staff it without getting everybody in it. How did
yeah,
you deal
it's
with
a great
that?
Point.
How did you deal with that in the plot?
Yeah, I actually have, I reconciled that by, this is, he's a multi, you know, a multi, multi billionaire and can basically find anything he wants. But one of the prerequisites to work, to be part of the crew was no family. So, and we, you know, with a man with that kind of resources can scour the world basically and find anybody he wants to. So one of the, that was the prerequisite even before signing a contract.
And then the question is, how do you know these people are actually going to stay loyal to you? Because, and at the, you know, the in the dystopian yeah. future, you know, maybe your paper money doesn't mean anything. And after a while, maybe Absolutely. They want the bunker and, you know, yeah.
Wow. It's addressed in the book too. Yeah, it's just one of the first things I thought about. What happens if Bitcoin goes away and paper currency goes away? And this article that I read in The Guardian, which gave me this first idea, there actually were billionaires that met with this man who wrote the book called Survival of the Richest. This is Douglas Rushkoff who wrote this book. But he met, and this is true, billionaires are actually, and he doesn't name them, he just says ultra wealthy, two of them were billionaires. Talking about that very same thing. How do we keep the special ops that are working for us? How do we keep them in control once we're underground? And they were literally thinking about, well, electric collars? And we laugh at this, but this is actually discussed. Some kind of implants that
wow.
have special blocks or, you know, codes for the food that only, you know, fail safe and all these. And they were actually sitting down talking about this. And it's one of the big things that got my imagination going, that these men actually, and I don't think there were women in that group, but these billionaires actually sat down and discussed this. It
so
sounds like
there's
no women in the
we got
group.
No
I'm
shot.
Already,
That's
I'm
what
already
you're
out.
Us.
And I'm
yeah,
just,
we're done. We're done as a
we've
species.
Got, yeah, we have no shot. No shot. Okay. On that happy thought. All right, Nancy, we'll get you two out with this.
Sorry.
What you've known Jim for a long time. You're very familiar with his work, with his writing. What was it about this book that made you want to nominate him for the pitch?
Okay, so once you start reading, you really do not want to stop reading this book. Not that there are zombies in this, but I was a huge Walking Dead fan until they killed off Glenn.
Yes.
Then I was done. But it, and as I'm reading this, I'm like, how did you know that? How do you know this stuff, Jim? How did you? And I'm thinking, we're sitting at the desk that Jim wrote a lot of this book at. I'm thinking he just sat over there and was researching, writing. But it's because it's so real.
Yeah.
And you feel the dread. And, you know, there are the people that are desperate on the outside. You know, they're sick. They're running out of water. They're ripping up the floorboards to burn in the fireplace. And 100 yards away from them, they know that there is everything they need, but they can't get in.
Yeah.
But then the people on the inside, it has this like horrible, like claustrophobic, because I mean, do you want to be 18 floors underground? No. And you never see the sun. And, you know, then there's that horrible thing. You could have everything you want, but what if you want is to be outside? So it's just going back and forth and back and forth.
All right. The little bit of it I've been able to read, Jim, it's really fantastic. So congratulations to you. Thank you for being part of this. Nancy, thank you so much. I'll touch base with you later this week. We'll catch up on the next round of this. But
and Tori, the really, book is?
The book is Sanctuary.
With great cover.
Thanks, you guys. Stay warm.
From Spring Green.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
I'm going to change the name of that town.
Oh,
if it's only
what part of the state is Spring Green in, Nancy?
We're about 40 minutes west of Madison, a little bit northwest of Madison. So it's beautiful.
My wife is from Hartford. So,
okay. So she's about an hour and a half away from us.
Correct. Correct. Yeah. Yes.
1,600 people in that town. I can change their minds. Gotta do it. Bye. Thanks, you guys. Mark Medley, you still with us?
I am definitely here. I was listening in with a lot of interest to that conversation, trying to figure
out. Very nice of you to say, sir.
What novel you were. I was Googling, trying to figure out the novel, and I discovered James Cleary, Sanctuary. It's not out yet, though.
It's not out yet. It comes out in April, I believe. I should have double checked that with Nancy, but I think it comes out
April
in April
26th. Yeah.
But it is, it's addictive. All I've been able to read so far is a little excerpt on it. It is addictive, but it just gets your mind racing because so much of it, I mean, you know, everybody throws around post-apocalyptic, which I cannot say. All of it can and probably is happening right now. Can and probably is.
Sorry, I thought a lot about what I would do if I was in this situation, and I've come to the conclusion is that I don't think I want to survive in that world, so I would be obsessed with getting in the bunker.
No, it was
I think that would be it. I'd say, okay, I had a good life. That's it.
Did you ever see that show Snowpiercer that was on TNT?
Oh yeah,
really good.
Movie first, yeah.
It was a movie first, right? But it was about the end of the world except on a train. Yeah. Hey, everybody that was alive was on this train that just went around the earth because of a billionaire who owned the train and had everything you wanted, but the poor people had to live 300 cars down, and it was just,
All right.
We're screwed. We got
anyway.
We're done. We're done.
It gets to that point, I'm not killing anybody.
Dolphins are
going to
be running the joint in about 100 years. That's where we're going.
Okay. From the
happier thoughts now.
From the scary, it is to happier thoughts. From the scarier to the inspirational, and for the millions of people listening to this, you should read this book by Mark Medley, Live to See the Day, Impossible Goals, Unimaginable Futures, and the Pursuit of Things That May Never Be. It is so inspirational. Every one of the many people, it's this wonderful Noah's Ark of people that Mark featured in the book. I want to take them home. I want to take them to dinner. I want to ask them a million more questions on top of what Mark ever shared with us. But Mark, thank you for joining. We love on Chatter, we love the backstory on our authors. So tell us where you're from, where you grew up, the day job, you're a real journalist.
Quote unquote, a real journalist. Yeah, no, I am. We're talking. First of all, thank you so much for having me. It's a delight to be here. I am in snowy Toronto, still digging my way out from yesterday's storm.
What's the temperature? Can you do it in Fahrenheit? Or do you
I can't do it in Fahrenheit. No, it's like minus 15 Celsius. We got 2 feet of snow, which was a city record. I have been talking about impossible goals. I've been digging out for 24 hours and I'm nowhere close to being done. I'm a journalist for the Globe and Mail, which is Canada's national newspaper.
Yes.
I've been a journalist for about 20 years. I have been books editor. This is a fun fact. I've been books editor of both of Canada's national publications. So I spent about 15 years doing what you guys do, interviewing authors for a living, mostly profiles. I didn't write reviews myself. I assigned the reviews. But, you know, I've wanted to be a writer since I was 6 years
Which
old.
of those, would you say 15 years?
About 15 years. I was books editor at the National Post for about 7 years and about 5 years here. So not 15 years, but long enough.
Which authors stand out of those you got to profile?
For good or bad?
Either.
I mean, you know, Margaret Atwood, who I've gotten to know quite well, is always a delightful interview just because she doesn't give you a moment's respite. She's always keeping you on your toes. Knausgård is fun to talk to. Jonathan Franzen, although the worst interview I've ever done was him in front of about 1,000 people here in Toronto.
Ooh, what happened?
You can look it up on YouTube.
Is
At
it
the Toronto
really
Public
bad?
Library,
We will, but tell us what happened.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd interviewed him before, probably when Freedom came out. We had a good rapport, and I was chosen to interview him for the public event here in the city at the Reference Library, which is like, the venue if you're an author. And it was a couple of days after my first son was born, and I was
Sleep
probably
deprived.
slept in 48 hours, and he got off the plane. I think he was coming in from Warsaw, and we met in the green room, and he kind of put his hand up right before, and he's like, "I lost my voice." So he didn't want to talk. He was in a bad mood. And maybe he wasn't in a bad mood. But once we got out there, it was, I was like a fish being filleted in front of 1,000 people. He's a very tough interview at the best of times. But, 3 minutes into the hour-long interview, I was like, this is going to be the longest hour of my life. And I thought I was going to go viral for all the wrong reasons.
All
But it's
right,
up there, unless they've taken it down out of pity for me.
that's right. We're not. He doesn't get on the show. That guy.
I
I
always
like
tell
him
people
too.
whenever I'm talking to agents, publicists, etc., the wonderful people with whom I work. Danielle helped arrange this interview. Thank you, Danielle. I always say I am always very clear saying if you've not experienced Chatter before, you need to understand and you need to listen to a couple episodes. This is not your mother's book club. We are not serious literary types, etc. And so nobody should be surprised when they come on. And I think in general, they get it and they're okay with it, I think. Okay, so you've interviewed countless authors. You know how hard the book world is. Whatever possessed you to write Live to See the Day?
I mean, going back, it was on my bucket list. As far as the things I wanted to live to see, it was write a book. I mean, it's cliched, but I would have been very disappointed if I'd come to the end of my career, the end of my life, and hadn't had one book on the shelf, just a single book. I felt I couldn't really do it as books editor. It would have been a conflict of interest, and I didn't want to, I didn't want publishers to sign me just because I was in a position of power, right? I never had an agent. I never tried to publish a book.
Boy, you're not from Washington, D.C., are you?
Well, I listen, people in my position have done it, like, no, whatever works best for them. But I wanted to divorce, my career as books editor with my career as an author. So when I stepped aside to do the job I do now, I'm in opinion. One of the first things I did was, find an agent and start thinking about books I wanted to do. And I had written a profile in 2008 about a politician here in Toronto who runs for office every election, knowing she's not going to win. And it remains one of my favorite stories ever.
This is Liz. You have to
Liz
tell us about
White.
her. I want Liz at my dinner party.
Of
We
course.
had one down here. We had Harold Stassen down here, ran for
There's a lot of
president.
them. I talk to a lot of American kind of fringe candidates who are in the same boat as Liz. But
In
Liz.
Montgomery County, it's Robin Ficker. Just
Robin Ficker. That's right. The
every
celebrated
district has it.
man. That's right.
So, this was 2008. There was a federal election here in Canada, and instead of, profiling one of the front runners, I wanted to profile somebody who had no hope in hell of going to Ottawa to Parliament. And Liz was running in my riding, and she had recently, within the past 3 years, founded or co-founded a party now called the Animal Protection Party of Canada. They're a one-issue party, animal rights, no testing on animals, ending the seal hunt, things like that. And for whatever reason, she agreed to let me shadow her for about a week. So we went door knocking. I sat in on party meetings as they strategize, went with her to debates, and I profiled her. And I was right. She got about 100 votes, 120 votes. But the thing is, she never stopped running. Even though she never got any closer to her goal, I would keep tabs on her over the years. And every time there was an election that she was eligible to run, which is pretty much every election, she would put her name down on the ballot. And it's not as if she was getting more votes over the years. It was always about 100 votes. And after about a decade of this, it struck me like, not everybody is willing to do that, right? Not everybody is willing to spend the time, the energy, the money, because it's costly in more ways than one, all in pursuit of a goal that she was not, she knew she's not delusional. She knew she wasn't going to do this, and yet she did it anyway. And I was batting around ideas with my editor, the publisher, And I said, look, what do you think of this? Like, are there other people like Liz White out in the world who pursue these goals no matter what, who run races knowing they might never hit the finish line? And he said, yeah, that sounds like a book. I had no idea what I was going to find. So basically I went out into the world to find more people like Liz White. And, you know, I was very surprised by the results.
And now you found us.
Exactly.
Now I
All of
found you.
us
Exactly.
who
This
have,
is where
all
I was
of
meant to
us
be.
here have unfulfilled
Doing this show
dreams.
until we hit 1 million listeners. That's right. Okay. There were so many wonderful characters in the book, Mark, and I want to get to at least three or four of them. But David, there's some analogy. There's some athletes, right, who just keep going no matter what.
Oh, well, sure. And Mark mentioned there are people that run in marathons that, if they finish at all, they don't finish in the top 7,000, but they keep running in marathons because it's not really about winning the marathon to them. It's about finishing the marathon, right? And so people's motivations are wildly different. There's people that play, I mean, it's hard to say if you're a professional athlete, you're a professional athlete, but there's people who never win a golf tournament, never win a tennis tournament,
Right.
and they're on the tour. And they're on the tour for years and years and years and years. You never come close to winning anything. But they keep playing, and part of it is love of the game, but part of it is this quality that certain people have that I thought was very, it's very telling, Mark, that there are people that really do kind of chase, not their dreams. That's not what I mean. It's just kind of like just chase the pursuit of pursuing for pursuing's sake.
Well,
it calls to mind two, very familiar aphorisms. One is, it's better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. And the other one, I mean, the big one is, people always say it's not the destination, it's the journey. And when you get to the destination, then you miss the journey. These people are living the journey, and they always have that enjoyment, I would guess.
And some of them, and we'll get to some of them right now, Mark, I promise. Some of them, when they start to visualize, they start to think about, okay, if I get it, if I find it, what's life going to be like afterwards? Because to David's point, it's the journey itself. But okay, Mark, we've got the mystery ape, we've got Superstition Mountains, we've got Richard and the pink-headed duck, might be my favorite. I
He's
totally
lovely.
want to take Richard home and adopt him. He's fabulous. Do the mystery ape first, because I think that's the closest one to a lot of people think about Bigfoot. I have a brother-in-law who's a very smart, well-educated, successful person. Bigfoot is real.
It's
He's not
interesting.
going on one of these quests to find him, but it's real. But tell us about the mystery ape.
Of course, I mean, when I set out to write this book, I didn't know what path it would lead me down, but I had a pretty good idea that I wanted to focus at least one chapter on cryptozoology, the pursuit,
Of
the
course.
search for, animals that probably don't exist. And I'd never heard of the Orrin Pendek. So the Orrin Pendek is the Sumatran version of Bigfoot. So Sumatra, it's an island part of Indonesia, and it has been, the stories have been told about this creature for centuries. The indigenous people who call the island home tell stories about it. Marco Polo referred to it in his journals during the era of the Dutch East Indies. Colonial settlers who were working on the island claim to have seen it. So Jeremy Holden is the focus of that chapter, and he's a British fellow who was traveling in Asia in his early 20s, just backpacking around, seeing the world as one is wont to do. And he met another British woman named Debbie Martyr, who had been spending quite a few, who had been in Indonesia for a number of years. And they hit it off. And after a week or two of hanging out on the island, she said, here, the reason I'm here is because I am researching this creature called the Orrin Pendek. I don't know if it exists, but I've heard stories, and being a journalist, I want to get to the bottom of this question. Jeremy decided he was going to stop traveling and help Debbie out on her journey. That same year, in the early 1990s, I think it was 1992, they both claimed to have seen the creature over the course of about a week. Conveniently, they didn't take photos, but I've talked to both of them, and I spent a long time with Jeremy, and I believe they definitely saw something. Whether it was the Orrin Pendek remains to be seen, but they basically decided they were going to spend the remainder of their lives trying to convince the world this exists. And for Jeremy, being a photographer, that meant he needed to get this on film. And so Debbie eventually stopped her pursuit. Now she is devoted to the conservation of the Sumatran tiger, which is a rare creature that we do know exists. But Jeremy's never stopped. And, he has pursued this creature, getting it on film to the detriment of, relationships, to the detriment of financial security, being estranged from his family at times. As he put it to me, he has given up any semblance of a normal life to get this creature on camera.
That came through with so many of the people in the bookmark, that the sacrifices they've made. And I was dying to know their families, the sacrifices they made, family sacrifices, professional sacrifices, financial sacrifices. Did you ever feel badly for them? Or
I
did
felt
the joy of their quest overcome worrying about them?
I was envious of them more than anything, right? Like Jeremy, for sure. There were times where he would spill his heart out to me. He's 60 now, but he's in his late 50s when I visited him in Sumatra. That, he had spent several decades, and he was no closer to his goal. And he said at one point, when I die, my gravestone is going to read, "Here lies the man who failed in his life's quest." And, at the same time, though, he has lived this wild, like, one of a kind life. And it wouldn't have happened if he hadn't had all these failures along the way. So despite the fact that, he'll admit it, he's probably never going to get this on film. He doesn't regret it, and I don't have any regrets on his behalf. If anything, I left Sumatra being like, I wish I could do that. And
Sure.
that was the case in a lot of the people I met. I mean, these are people who have, in some ways, like a very weird courage. I didn't think it was going to be courage when I started writing, but it is courageous to take this
Totally
kind of risk.
courageous.
It is courageous to, quote unquote, like waste your life, right? But I don't think they're wasting their lives.
Richard's mom, who had friends laugh at her because he's off looking for the pink-headed duck, which we'll get back
Exactly.
to. So you had people looking for animals that may or may not exist or have gone extinct. You had people listening for voices from outer space. By the way, I totally believe there was life elsewhere, those kinds of
Oh, me
things.
too. Yeah.
Which of them did you find you were very neutral? I mean, in the best sense of the word, as you were describing these different people, Mark. Which do you find the most believable?
I mean, I'm with you. SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. I'm somebody who does believe that there's life elsewhere in the universe. It just is too
Maybe a different kind, but
different kind, exactly. It's something that I've been very passionate about since I was a kid. I grew up on Star Trek and Star Wars. In another life, I would have loved to, work for NASA or
not
be
too
an
late.
astronomer.
Not too late. Okay, wait, David, life outside our particular universe, yes or no?
Oh, absolutely. Of course there is. Yeah, sure.
Well, how do you
Absolutely.
envision it?
I have no idea. I mean, I can't do the thing that we always do, which is they sort of look like humans, but they got their heads shaped a little funny. Like, no, come on. It might be a
Why are their heads
plant.
always really big?
It
Whenever
might be
people put
a
and
plant that
brains.
emanates waves that you can understand. I don't know. Like, how do you know? I have no
I
idea what
don't.
it is.
Jamie McIntyre, life outside, yes or
Well,
no?
the vastness of the universe and the infinite permutations would seem to indicate that we're not the only life form. But I kind of just as a I affectionately sort of adhere to the Isaac Asimov model, where it all started on this planet that's long forgotten called Earth. And billions of years from now, when there's life everywhere, people will be talking about this mother planet that where life started for the whole universe. But nobody knows where it is anymore because it's long gone.
And those weird tech bros that
And
Jim DeVita's writing about will be there because
yeah,
they're
I
looking
so I
forever.
kind of think like maybe we're this beginning of the whole thing. That's just my opinion.
Okay, so definitely life outside the universe. We don't know what it looks like or sounds like, whatever. And then, and Mark, you got into it a little bit with some of your the people you featured, this notion of animals. And just because they don't communicate like us doesn't mean they aren't communicating at some pretty significant levels. But the pink-headed duck, not necessarily a great communicator, but, and again, Richard, my favorite. I want to take him home. I want to take care of him. I want to fund his next expedition, which I can't do. But tell us about Richard and the Pink-Headed Duck.
I mean, Richard's a great example of it's never too late to try something new and change your life, as you were talking about before. It's not too late for me. He was a gentleman who, basically, up until about 20 years ago, he was working as a clerk in a clothing store in a very small kind of English village about an hour south of London. You know, as he said to me, he would spend his day selling socks and underwear to gentlemen in the village. And one day, over his lunch break, he went to the local library and he found a book called Vanishing Birds by the biologist, Richard Halliday, I think it is. And he took it back to the lunchroom and he just, you know, as he ate his fish and chips, he was flipping through it and he came across the story of the pink-headed duck. Now, unlike the Orrin Pendek, we know the pink-headed duck
Did accept.
existed within the last century. You know, there's a lot of been written about it. It's a beautiful book. Beautiful bird, pink-headed duck, that lives in Asia, India, and Myanmar and Bangladesh. And for whatever reason, even though the book he was reading says it was extinct and hasn't been seen in the wild in, you know, almost a century, he decided he was going to find it, which, okay. But it wasn't that he just said this to himself. He actually ended up becoming a one-man authority on the pink-headed duck and starting to self-fund expeditions to mostly Myanmar, which is a very, very difficult country to travel to. And this was somebody who had, you know, no scientific background, had no connections with any, you know, conservation or wildlife organizations at all. And for the last, 15, 20 years, he has been on this one-man quest. And it's one man because he does not like to work with other people. I did not get to go to Myanmar with him. He wouldn't allow me. I just got to visit him in the UK. And he does this while, you know, also doing his job as an ambulance driver now. He works for the National Health Services.
Because of course you're selling socks and underwear one day, and then you become an ambulance driver.
Exactly,
He's
exactly.
one of the ones that were, I was really struck by him thinking about envisioning what it would be like when he sees it, or when he gets the first sighting. And the thing about getting the cameras into the region to try to see them was just insane. But he seemed to be obsessing a little bit about, okay, when it happens, it's going to be huge, and it will be like when they first saw the first shots of the Titanic when it was found on the floor of the ocean, those kinds of things. When you hear him talking like that, do you worry for him?
Yeah, he's one of those people who, you know, with everybody I talk to when I'm profiling them, you talk to people around them, friends and family. And for almost everybody in this book, I did that, including Richard. And he's somebody who his friends admitted, you know, they are worried what would happen, A, if he found it, because, you know, he takes
Then,
such joy
yeah, the quest
from
is
the
over.
search. It would be like, what would he do? But yeah, I do kind of worry what will happen if he doesn't find it, because the odds are stacked against him. You know, I do admit there's a chance it's still out there. As people from Rewild told me, there are new species or old, there are extinct species being refound every single week. Like this happens all the time, but not something necessarily on the scale of the pink-headed duck. So yeah, for somebody who has devoted so much time, so much money, and who thinks about it, like the thing with Richard is, you know, over the few days I spent with him, all he wanted to do was kind of daydream about the day he finds it. And, you know, am I gonna, do I need an agent? How am I going to, you know, how's it gonna transform my life? And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, I hope you're not hurt by this in the long run. I hope that you can find some kind of solace, even if it never happens. And like, you know, we're not gonna know whether that happens or not until, you know, the end of his life, but
I think you're, I don't know if solace is the right word, but I think your book has probably given a lot of these people and their friends and relatives solace, validation. Wow, this is pretty cool.
I didn't
Really
expect
cool.
that.
Well,
And
yeah.
you're right. You're right. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons people sat down to talk to me, because I emailed them out of the blue and I say, I'm writing a book about people who are not going to achieve what they want
People
to
who are
achieve.
crazy.
Yeah. And you would think as a journalist, they would go the other way. And some people did. Not everybody wanted to talk to me. But I think for somebody like Richard, who hasn't been able to share his story that much, he loved to be able to talk to me for 3 days straight about here's why I do what I do and here's what I want to get out of it. So I
All of
did.
his friends and relatives are probably sick about hearing about the pink-headed duck by now. So they found you and like, woo. Okay, Jamie, if you had one quest on which you could pursue something crazy, what would it be? And then David. Claude's really busy tonight doing snow duty for somebody, so I can't ask him.
I can't get over the fact that I just keep thinking that maybe I'm just a contrarian, but you know, you've portrayed these people very sympathetically and compassionately, and you know, said, you know, you don't think they're wasting their lives, and from everything you've said, they sound kind of deluded to me on a quixotic quest for something that doesn't.
Everybody loves Don Quixote until you live next to him.
I'm not so sure that these are healthy people. That's all.
In many ways, I think they're among the healthiest. Among the healthiest. Having that kind of challenge, that kind of pursuit, yeah, that's more important than anything else.
Your challenge was to, you know, cure cancer, and you never achieved it. I would feel different.
You're adding the body of knowledge.
Pink-headed duck is not quite the same thing.
Did any of you guys watch the crazy guy who climbed the Taipei skyscraper the other night?
Alex Honnold. Honnold, I think.
Yeah. Did you watch it?
Yeah, I'm a fan of him.
Insane. I'm a fan of his. Free solo, incredible. And I heard about this, and I kept saying to my husband, I don't care what else we're doing, we are watching that. He's like, yeah, sure, whatever. And it was delayed because there was bad weather. So it was on Friday night. I guess it was Friday night, East Coast time, Saturday, and whenever it was insane. So it's a 1600 foot skyscraper. He climbs it, no ropes, no nets, no nothing. Insane.
Yeah, watched the guy who jumped above Earth. That jumped out of the. Well, yeah. He just passed away, I think, last year.
And of course, The Wire, the guy between the Twin Towers.
Yeah. Guys, nothing compared to this guy. No nets, no ropes, no nothing. The greatest thing was, and I'm terribly afraid of heights. I was transfixed. Brian, my husband, had to keep getting up and walking away. He couldn't watch it.
Yeah, I can't watch that.
But here's where I'm kind of in between where Jamie and David are, where you are, Mark. And this is that guy now has a significant other and two children. You don't get to do that stuff when you've got a significant other and two children, I don't think. And I don't care how much his wife seemed lovely and wonderful and supportive. I don't care how much she says, this is what he loves doing. This is his quest. He needs to do this, those kinds of things. No, you don't get to do that. And
but he had a quest and he had a dream and he accomplished it.
He did. But what if he hadn't, Jamie?
Well, now he's going to have to climb a taller skyscraper. Because it's never quite over with the.
OK,
my favorite story among my favorite stories, I should say, is Dr. Seuss.
Oh,
because Dr. Seuss got rejected 27 times by 27 different publishing houses before somebody finally published his first book.
Yeah.
And I always think about a guy like Dr. Seuss. And the 17th time they go, good Lord, this guy Geisel's here again.
Have to pitch my novel like six more times. And then
when you talk to these people, like, how did you kind of reconcile? I love that they believe in this so much that they're willing to give up everything, because very few people are willing to do that. Isn't there some amazing amount of unhappiness in their life that there's nothing else that they're doing, that there's nothing else that gets them excited?
That's a good way of putting it.
Pink-headed duck.
It's a really good looking duck, David.
I wouldn't go so far as their quests are the only thing that kind of get them out of bed in the morning. For sure, it is the thing that kind of propels them the most. It's the thing that motivates them the most. But, you know, there are people in this book who do have some semblance of, you know, they have families, they have children, they have friends. Not everybody is living in the, you know, rainforest of Sumatra at all. But at the same time, like, I want to go back to what Jamie was saying is, you know, yes, you know, there is a lot of delusion, I think, in this book. And I think in writing this book, I have kind of done a 180, and I see delusion as not necessarily an awful thing. And I think the thing that has stayed with me, or the thing I wanted to present in this book, is that these are the people who, even if they're doing things that you and I would not do and raise an eyebrow when we hear, They're the things that kind of give texture and color to life. Like, I like, as a journalist, writing about the eccentrics, the people who are kind of, carving their own path, and the people who, because I'm the kind of person who's not. Like, I have lived a very, very kind of like boring, vanilla life. I do the path of least resistance, and these people are the opposite of that. And, I have a lot of admiration for that, even if, yes, I might, disagree or believe, they're probably not going to achieve these goals. I mean, they know it. They know they're not going to do it.
I think I know the answer to this question, but I'll ask it anyhow to get you out with this. But we're not letting you go because we have to do 60 seconds more. David, did you ever, when you were working on this book, 6 years? Quite a few years, right? You've been working on this?
Started in 2019, so
Yeah.
7 years. Yeah.
7 years. Did you ever think of giving up?
I did 100%. I sold this book in the fall of 2019. I'd been doing research for the proposal, throughout that year, but I actually sold it to PRH in 29 end of 2019. And I thought it was going to take me 2 years. I actually thought this book was going to come out. The contract, I think, said 2022. And a couple of months after I signed the contract, the pandemic hit. And especially here in Canada, for 2 years, it was very, very difficult to travel. And most of the
Sure.
people I knew I wanted to write about were not located here. I had to go, to the States. I had to go to the UK. I had to go to Asia, Norway. And I didn't know how long the pandemic was going to last. And I remember going down to my basement office every single day to conduct an interview over Zoom or do some research or write a sentence, thinking to myself, why am I doing this? Like, am I wasting my time? Am I going through the motions for something that is actually never going to see the light of day? Like, am I writing a book that's never going to appear on the bookshelf? And
Yeah.
I didn't know. But the thing about that is, in a way, I became one of the characters in the book. I, got to experience on a very, very small size what the people I was writing about do, because I too kept going, right? I never stopped. And it was like, oh yeah, it's because this brings me joy, this brings me meaning. And I would have kept going. I would still be writing this book now if the world was still shut down, probably. And I
Yeah.
didn't know it was going to come out because, it was the most fascinating thing I've ever done. And I was really, really happy to spend all this time with all these really interesting people.
Yeah, you gave great. I just feel like I really knew these people. I really didn't want the book to end.
Thank you.
But I feel like I really got to know these people, and I'm going to miss them. We didn't get to talk about Superstition Mountains, where I've been, Lost Dutchman Mine. I know that whole story very well. Ron Feldman has got to be played by Harrison Ford in the movie. Has to be played by Harrison Ford in the movie. Okay. It's absolutely fabulous. The book is Live to See the Day by Mark Medley. Everyone should get this. If you, it's just a fabulously fun book, but it's also inspirational. Makes you think more positively about life, Jamie and David, your cynical outlooks on this notwithstanding.
Hey, Chatterheads, it's Jamie here with a couple of quick items before you go. First of all, thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate your time. There are, however, a few things you can do to help us keep Chatter chugging along. Of course, you can follow us in all the usual places, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Join us on Patreon for bonus outtakes from the show, including Tori's rapid-fire lightning round with the guest and some pre- and post-show persiflage that we usually edit out. Go to chatteronbooks.com to subscribe to our monthly newsletter, where you'll get a sneak peek at the upcoming authors. And don't forget, if you're buying books, please try bookshop.org. It's easy, it's online, and the best thing is you'll be supporting your favorite independent bookstores and affiliates like Chatteron Books. So, download us wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a review on Apple if you're feeling so disposed. But, most importantly, just stay in touch. Send questions, comments, ideas, and even insults to info@chatteronbooks.com. That's info@chatteronbooks.com. And thanks again for listening. Stay safe. We'll see you next time.
This one is Live to See the Day. I'm telling you, people, it's really fun. It's really inspirational. It is just, I really didn't want it to end, and I want to take all those people to dinner. So if they're ever in the United States, let me know. We'll take you all to dinner. Claude, thanks very much, my friend. I know you're working hard doing 18 jobs tonight. David, Jamie, Nancy, Jim DeVita, our second nominated author for The Pitch. Congratulations. And Mark, really terrific. Thank you for writing the book, and thank you for sharing this time with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank
Really
you so
appreciate it.
much.
We are back, everybody, in 2 weeks with Matthew Delmont. I don't know him, but I know friends who know him. So that counts. He's the author of Until the Last Gun is Silent, Story of Patriotism, Vietnam War, and the Fight to Save America's Soul. Everybody, thank you for listening. Stay warm, and we will see you soon. And we're out.